We've heard from so many people who say they've tried everything to quit porn. Filters, blockers, restricting access to apps, even flip phones, only to fall back into the same cycle. Because the real battle isn't with your browser, it's with what you're feeling. That's the problem Relay is designed to solve. Relay helps you spot the triggers behind your urges and connects you to a community that actually understands what you're going through. Instead of fighting this alone, you get accountability, tools, and real-time support when you need it most. And that's not about shame. It's about building a life where you don't need porn anymore. And right now is the best time for you to try it. For our No Porn November campaign, Relay is offering a free 30-day trial to our listeners. Imagine going a whole month without porn. It's possible with real accountability and support backing you up. Head to joinrelay.app/consider and start your 30 days free today.
In today's episode of Consider Before Consuming, we hear from Ryan Ridgway, a mental health educator and advocate from the UK. Ryan shares how porn became his way to manage stress, and how OCD and self-esteem played into his addiction. Once he realized how those patterns were affecting his life, he began the process of recovery. Now, he's helping others through awareness, education, and support. With that, let's jump into the conversation. We hope you enjoy this episode of Consider Before Consuming.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on Consider Before Consuming today. I'm really looking forward to get to have this conversation with you and share this with our listeners. Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and the work you do in the mental health field?
Yeah, so 10 years ago, I was the deputy manager for our National Health Service in the United Kingdom, got close to mental health teams, branched out on my own to teach mental health first aid, mental health support, and that's gone into areas of addiction support as well. I am a former Samaritan, that's like our crisis helpline in the UK. I teach our main mental health charity in the UK, but the thing I think that qualifies me the most is I've had my own journey with mental illness, live with it from about the age of 12, earliest memory, and it was only 5 years ago, I spent time in a mental health hospital as a result of my mental illness. So I think that lived experience counts for more than anything in terms of qualifications or, you know, PhDs and things like that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that with us. What first sparked your interest in conversations about mental health and also pornography, which we're here to talk a little bit about today?
Back in my day, I think I get to say that at the age of 44, mental health wasn't a conversation. So you were almost encouraged to keep it in, don't talk about it, you know, hide it away. You know, I've seen that transition over the years when we went from don't talk about that to, you know what, I'm going to share my lived experience. And if I do that in the right way, it might form part of someone else's survival guide. Within that 10 years of teaching and meeting great people, more and more people have approached me afterwards and said, you know what, given what we talked about today, I think I've got a problem with pornography. I think it's a habit and even an addiction. And that's increased dramatically. So that firsthand experience of people pulling me aside after the training and saying, you know, that thing we talked about, can I ask you about that? And then I've realized that I've had my own journey with recovery with that as well.
Yeah. As you reflect back on those experiences, what role did pornography play early on for you?
I remember the days before the internet. So again, I've seen that transition of magazines and the old VHS tape that you had to kind of borrow out of your dad's drawer. And then suddenly the internet, you know, became a thing. And that was really kind of scary in the fact that addiction, pornography has got three A's no other addiction's ever had. It's anonymous. No one knows. It's accessible 24/7, you know, through a laptop or a smartphone or a tablet, and it's affordable. It's absolutely free. No other addiction, gambling, alcohol, drugs can fit those three A's. And that seek for dopamine, that if that's your thing, I'm seeing more people ringing sick for work and lose jobs. And for me, it crept in through the back door, 1% per day, you know, fun with problems and just problems. It was a bit of a lifelong 20-year journey with pornography to the point where I went, you know what, I've got a problem with this. I've lost the power of control and it's having a detrimental effect on my life.
Yeah. What was it like to come to that realization, to recognize that this was something that was really affecting you?
it was hard because it's something that when I kind of realized no one was really talking about, and it's something that's almost societally celebrated. You know, like, I'm gambling. There's something wrong with gambling. You get gambling adverts and alcohol and, you know, that bravado amongst men as well. It's almost like normalized and usualized.
Right.
So, yeah, it wasn't like a sudden, wow, I've got a problem with this. It just crept in to the point where I went, I need to change this. It's removing the joy in everyday life. You know, the going for a walk, having a chat with a friend, a coffee, that wasn't of interest anymore. It just lost its purpose to the point where it was kind of owning my life, and I had to make a change, and I didn't really know where to go or how to start that conversation.
Yeah, which is such a common experience that we hear from individuals who have a habit that's something that escalated to something they maybe never thought it would, and recognizing that it is causing difficulty in their life. I want to ask you a little bit about, you've been open about your OCD diagnosis. And for people who might not understand obsessive compulsive tendencies, how can something like OCD show up in relation to pornography use?
Very easily. So typically people think OCD is about germ phobia or being neat and tidy, but there's lots of different subcategories it can attach to. So typically it's religion, one of a sexual nature, it can be causing harm to others, things like that. So because there's a subcategory of a sexual nature, if someone were into pornography and consuming that, then it could easily manifest in so many different ways. The person could have intrusive thoughts about the video they've just watched, or intrusive thoughts about, you know, inappropriate behavior around sex or extreme behaviors. And even though we know now, because there's more education about OCD, when the person worries about that thing, it's almost the opposite of their moral compass. But the person might think, wow, is that me? Why am I thinking these things? And they try to wrestle with those intrusive thoughts, and it can have a really detrimental effect on someone's OCD or mental illness.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. As you've kind of discovered that relationship, have you heard from others who've experienced something similar?
Yeah, absolutely have. Lots of people approach me about obsessive compulsive disorder and find it really hard to talk to other people about it who don't understand, because it's quite taboo. You know, how do you explain to someone who doesn't understand OCD that you're having these intrusive thoughts? Typically people will react with, oh, I can't believe you're thinking that, and that's you. So a lot of people will open up and share and talk because they find that relief in someone who understands that that isn't them. It's an intrusive thought. It doesn't mean anything. It's not a reflection on their person or their character. So a lot of people will reach out and share these things.
And I think that's something that sounds similar to what we hear with individuals who discover that they have a pornography habit, that they often feel like they're the only one that has, you know, lost control of this thing. How might someone recognize when a habit like pornography use is shifting into something that is more compulsive or harmful?
I think it is quite hard to recognize without awareness. And that's why I love what you guys do. I love the site, I love the data and the sharing of information. So without that, it'd be quite hard to realize that this thing that everyone thinks is acceptable and it's okay and it's a bit of fun actually has got such a grip on someone's life now. You know, they call it like the gift of desperation. Only when you're at rock bottom do you go, whoa, hang on, what's going on here? I need to change it. So for me, it was things like cancelling plans with friends and choosing to do that for fun rather than going to the gym and having that effect on my physical health, my mental health. It was almost like that was the only thing I could do to relax. And when I started to cancel plans, let people down and, you know, not walk the dogs, I just started to question, this isn't fun anymore. This is having a really, it's just having a negative effect, and I need to change it.
It sounds like it became kind of your primary coping mechanism for whatever you're experiencing in life.
Yeah, 100%. Unprocessed stress, that was the go-to. If I had an amazing week at work and I'd showed up for everyone, you know, I'd ticked all the boxes of responsibility, they'd be like, right, now I can allow myself some space to do that thing. And the trance state of addiction as well. So maybe you've got a really busy week of work, so you're like, right, I'm going to have to do all this stuff, but on Saturday or Sunday, I'm going to get some time for me. No one's going to know. But in that moment when you make that decision, that's almost like the addictive process has started. You're fast forwarding your life to get to that day or that point where you could do that thing. So your whole life kind of centers around it. And it was that. It was like, this isn't a way to live. This is turned into something nasty and something I need to change.
Right. And we know from research with behavioral addiction that you're triggering that reward pathway in the brain, right? And some of that is related to the hormones that you're chasing to feel good, like dopamine, serotonin, right? You've mentioned dopamine stacking before. Can you explain what that means and why it's something that people should be aware of?
Yeah, and I think I've just kind of gave it that name, but more and more people are approaching me and saying, look, you talked about porn addiction, didn't consider it to be addiction, but I've got a problem with that. And then they add to that, you know, what I've realized is, you know, pornography use or consumption is more exciting when I'm drunk. So now I'm combining alcohol with pornography, or it's even more kind of exciting and driven when I'm on cocaine or drugs. So that you've not just got the standard addiction. People are now choosing to do the two together, which can give it that extra layer of complexity.
And what kind of impact can that combination of, you know, multiple behaviors or substances have on someone's, you know, mental health and recovery journey?
I think it can make it harder because you're not just combating that one thing. You're now combating two. You know, you take a substance, the effect that's going to have on your neurotransmitters, brain chemicals, serotonin combined with the pornography consumption. So the person can feel a little bit lost. Like if I had those two things, do I go to AA or do I look for pornography recovery? You know, do I go to CA or NA? It's almost like you can feel like in a bit of a lost space, because if I go to one of these support groups, it's handling that thing. If I go to that, it doesn't take that kind of dual diagnosis, integrated treatment model into caring for the whole person as an individual. And actually they're dealing with these two things combined.
Right. And I think that can be really tricky because in almost all instances, seeking out substances or addictive behaviors, pornography, gambling, things that you've mentioned already, are, as we talked about, coping mechanisms. And so if the solution isn't addressing that root cause, then sometimes it's not, you know, we're just looking at the symptom rather than the root cause.
Yeah, that's it. It's almost like the solution to the problem, seeking these things out. And that was kind of how pornography started for me, in a sense. I never wanted to be that person in a relationship that would cheat. I didn't want to be that guy. And, you know, just that wasn't for me. But how could I satisfy that kind of urge of cheating without cheating, if that made sense? It was almost right. Like, well, I don't want to be that guy. That's not me morally. I'm not going to be that person. I don't want to treat people that way. But there's something there that I need to kind of resolve. And that's where pornography was like the sticking plaster over that thing, that coping strategy. But that thing I used to cope, you know, that just got worse, got more, took over and became the problem in itself. Because I was watching porn but didn't want to cheat, you know, I didn't want to be that person. That's where porn would be more attractive, because you can kind of live out your fantasies and your realities via a screen without kind of doing it in reality. I've got a friend who I know, you know, he's very into dating apps, and there's a big connection there between he'll consume pornography and then what he's kind of seen on screen or who he's seen. He'll want to go and seek that out on a dating app. And then when that's happened, he's ticked the box, it's on to the next. And it's almost like this cycle of, you know, I want to kind of be with everyone of different hair color and size and type. It's just, yeah, it's habitual. And he's come to the realization that, you know, I think I've got a problem. And he started to talk about it.
Yeah, it's almost like pursuing, you know, physical characteristics or body parts rather than pursuing a person for a relationship.
That's it. It's not a relationship with the person. It's that superficial body parts, hair color, eye color, all of that kind of stuff. Rather than get to know the individual, their heart, their soul, and what makes them tick, get to know them as a person. And I definitely think that porn consumption can accelerate that for people, where they just see people as possessions, as belongings, as options, rather than building something that's meaningful and true.
Yeah. within relationships that you were in that you did consume pornography in, is that something that your partner knew about? Is that something that was kind of open and expected in relationships? Or do you feel like it was something you were really hiding in those relationships?
100% hiding in every relationship apart from the current one. So my partner, yeah. She's also in recovery. That's where we met. And it was probably about 3 years into the relationship before I opened up and admitted to that, you know, admitted to this consumption. But because she is in recovery and knows it can make, you know, take many different forms, she was very accepting of that. And even that moment of being honest with my partner for the first time and, you know, being okay to talk about rather than shut down and judged and condemned, that was a real relief.
Yeah. What did the process of recovery look like for you?
It's been a long journey. So initially I went into Cocaine Anonymous, CA, in a 12-step program. But then I was 8 months sober from everything, you know, pornography, alcohol, drugs. But then I got sectioned. That's when I spent time in a mental health hospital. And it was almost like in those programs, and you help loads of people. They can be amazing. But in there, it was removing these coping strategies. But they're not really, it didn't really teach me or my group how to build the life you wanted. So I came out of hospital and then I paid for a therapist, an addiction specialist, a great, great person. And I've been seeing them every 2 to 3 weeks for maybe two and a half years. So that was more a slower process of recovery. You know, relapses happen. There's Unhooked podcast, which is great, that Jeremy Lipswich, and he really helped me out. Your channel, your information. Now, I mean, there's no one fix. It's almost like, let me gather all this information and apply it in a way that works for me. You know, Relay is brilliant as well. One of your sponsors, use them. No one thing. It's almost like if you do enough of those things, they might only help 1%, but when you do them all together, that's 10%. And that's another day sober. It's another day without consumption. It's another day when you're building the life you want and moving further away from the life that you just don't want.
Yeah. And with that, I guess, how did you shift that mindset from, rather than just looking at what you wanted to stop, the behaviors you wanted to stop, into what you wanted to build? How did that look for you?
Shifting that mindset, I think it was just over time, you just got so sick of this repetitive behavior having a detrimental effect on your life. So one step at a time, one foot in front of the other. And it kind of started that shift in mindset with talking about the problem, you know, the shame, the guilt, the embarrassment you might hold, thinking you're the only one struggling with this. Then finding that supportive community of people who maybe are further along the journey than you, and they can help you forward. And then you look back and you help someone behind you. So it's almost like the inspiration from other people that I, you know, listen to podcasts on your channel of, and the information where I'm like, oh, wow, people do talk about this. It is a problem. And they do recover. Now they're further ahead and they're living the life or building the life that they want. So that talking thing is huge. That getting it out of your head, unraveling thoughts, feelings, emotions, letting the words hit the air and take away some of their negative power.
Yeah. And I want to thank you again for being on our podcast today so that you can help share your story so others feel less alone as well. We know there's so much power in being able to kind of break shame down in this way. So thank you again for your time and vulnerability and willingness to share this with us. What surprised you most about your recovery, either about yourself or about the process?
What surprised me the most, I think, was that moment, and I can't really think about when that was, when you're almost feeling like you're free of it, like it's lost its interest. You know, that those cognitive pathways, that dopamine, it can be so entrenched, so ingrained. You think, I'm never going to want to do anything else. You know, my mind is just constantly thinking about that. And then gradually, one day at a time, you get to a point where you just go, oh, wow, I don't battle with it anymore. I don't struggle with it. I don't seek it out. And in fact, if you offered it me now, I'd be like, no, I've got better things to do. So that was really surprising, because never ever thought I'd be that free, where I just didn't even consider it. So that was quite a nice moment where you look back and go, I've come quite far. And you never want to take it for granted. You know, it's always a process of moving forward. I'm very aware with addiction, if you stop doing some of these things, then it's like doing press-ups in the car park. It's waiting for you to slip up. But also, you know, doesn't have to be in fear about it. And I think that was the thing that I found in some of the 12-step programs, that fear of if you stop going meetings, you'll relapse. If you stop doing this, I'm like, wow, this is hard work. I'm almost miserable. Surely it should be sober and happy and easy and freeing and peaceful. And to find that space, I was like, oh, that's a nice surprise.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that in that way, because I think for so many people on a journey to improve mental health or overcome addiction, that process of doing the work in between kind of the rock bottom that forces you to decide if you want to make a change and that kind of light at the end of the tunnel, that work is difficult. And I think it's common for people to say, well, this, I'm feeling worse than I was before. This can't be better. So to know that there's that light at the end of the tunnel, I think can be really encouraging for people to hear from someone who's been through that.
Absolutely. I see it all the time in my teaching. You know, the people have reached out maybe a couple of years ago. I send them the link to your website and they come back all the time and say, well, you know what? It does work. We can get there. And it is a process. You know, if someone was drowning, you wouldn't teach them to swim at that point. Like there's a process to this. And also that fear of relapsing and being able to go, you know what, I messed up. That's okay. Let's move forward. Let's learn from that. What were the triggers? What was the situation? Rather than the shame of, oh, I don't want to tell anyone that I've relapsed. It's like, you relapsed. We're human. Let's talk about it. Let's learn from it. Let's move forward. How many days was it? 10? Right, we're going to go for 20. You know, give me a call if ever you feel like, you know, that urge, that impulse.
Yeah, that's something that I'm so glad you mentioned, because I think a lot of people often see setbacks as failures in addiction recovery. And I love the way you framed that the setback is actually a tool to learn, you know, what drove you to this. And it's information that can help you toward recovery if you can look at it in the right way. So to know that it's not a failure, it's just part of the process, I think is helpful for people to hear as well.
Yeah, it is. It's part of the process. We're human. We're not perfect. But if you can take that experience and learn from it. And there's been loads of times in my journey like that. So for example, you know, way back when I used to have an office without a window with a lockable door, it was just a prime opportunity where that impulse could take hold. So I moved myself to an office without a lock, with a window. And, you know, there's that practical step, as silly as it sounds, that then it reduced the opportunity. So there's lots of different practical steps, spiritual steps, community-based steps, build that recovery journey that's unique to you, but use those relapses as a learning, as a lesson.
Yeah. For anyone who's listening who might relate to your story, what's one small step you would encourage them to take toward healing?
I think the one small step that's actually the biggest step and the most important step is admitting it to yourself and someone else. You know, finding someone you can be honest with, drive down that shame that surrounds this stuff. And have an accountability partner. So mine is one of my best friends. He's the co-host of our Mental Reset YouTube channel that's due to launch soon. It's all about men's mental health. And he doesn't struggle with an addiction of any type, but he's like my accountability partner. I know I can be honest with him. And, you know, if there's a problem, I can ring him. If there was a relapse, I'd tell him, we'd explore it, he'd ask open questions. So talking, finding that person to be honest with, having that, you know, accountability partner.
Yeah, that was so beautifully said. You know, we know there is so much power in sharing your story and having support. And that's one of the reasons, actually, that we love Relay, which you mentioned earlier. So our longtime friends at Relay have developed an app that matches you with a small supportive group of peers who understand exactly what you're going through. And together, you set goals and check in daily and encourage each other as you work toward freedom. It's like having a team always in your corner or support in your pocket, reminding you that recovery is possible. And we've seen how powerful it can be when someone finally realizes that they don't have to fight this battle on their own. And Relay makes that kind of connection safe, straightforward, and even anonymous. Right now, during No Porn November, Relay is giving our listeners 40% off for anyone who signs up during the month of November. If you've been thinking of making a change, this is your chance. Start today at joinrelay.app/consider. That's joinrelay.app/consider. So Ryan, as you've spoken with others about their experiences and done work in mental health support, have you noticed any recent trends in the way that pornography use can escalate?
With regards to pornography use, trends that people will kind of share is, you know, when they're using substances, alcohol, for example, and they're watching pornography use, they say, you know, it becomes more extreme. I'm going into spaces that I wouldn't usually venture into sober, and that's a concern. And that wasn't the case for me, which is why I think it flew for so long under the radar. It'd be the same kind of, you know, almost obsessively watching the same videos. It didn't get more extreme or go into other spaces, but I do have that shared with me from others where they say, you know what, it really impacted my moral compass. I was watching, you know, violent videos or things that I just, the next day I thought, this has got to stop. So that is a trend. And we know the risk with that, with pornography. And you share, and I never knew this back in the day, that it's non-consensual and it's abuse, and it's just, I can't support that. Now I know about these facts, I'm just like, no way. I've got to support the work you do and get this message out there and give people the facts. Unless they've got the facts and the awareness, they're not making an informed decision.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I think so many people, similar to what you said, have this belief that because something is made in mainstream pornography, that it must be ethically produced and consensual, and everyone's over the age of 18, and it's completely fine because it's quote unquote just entertainment. And we know from research and personal stories that that's not always true, and that, you know, force, fraud, and coercion are happening in the mainstream porn industry more than most people would ever believe that they are. But it's something that so many people don't know. And so I think that is kind of the first step, is getting that education out there. But as you mentioned, you were consuming content that was fairly violent, or, you know, you weren't sure whether how it was produced. Did you notice how that was affecting your perception of the world, or how you saw other people in everyday life?
Yeah, it shapes your perspective on relationships, expectations of intimacy. I think maybe there's a trend there of porn consumption and people moving on to relationships very quickly, you know, especially with dating sites. You know, back in my day, couples kind of stayed together longer, you know, worked on a relationship, worked on communication. And there seems to be a trend now of my younger friends, and they'll say, you know what, it didn't work out, and they're on to the next partner, the next partner, you know, making comments around the intimacy with that partner. They didn't do this, they didn't do that. So, yeah, I think it's undeniable that it can shape your frame of reference, your window on the world, and your expectations. And social media does that, right? We see the perfect holiday and the car and the perfect life. So why wouldn't it do that with relationships if someone's consuming a lot of pornography?
Right. Was that something that you noticed, the process of kind of breaking down the way that it had maybe influenced your expectations of intimacy in your healing process? Were you aware of where you had some of those expectations that you had to confront?
Really, the thing where it influenced my expectation and affected my mental health was not feeling good enough. You know, you'd see these performers and you think, well, I don't look like that, and I'm not that size, that shape, and it was very much like an impact on self-esteem for me, rather than an expectation on my partner to be like this or do that. It was me kind of thinking, well, I'm not good enough. And it really affected self-esteem, because you start to think, well, that's normal. That's what all men look like, right? And I don't look like that. So that was hard. And that definitely influenced things like steroid misuse. You know, I've used steroids. I'm a former pro MMA fighter. I've only had two fights. The one I lost is on YouTube. The one I won is nowhere to be seen. That's typical. But, you know, covered in tattoos and that bravado, it kind of was celebrated in that realm. But when you're watching these videos, you're just like, oh, I'm not good enough. I need to be bigger or stronger or more ripped. And there was a level of body dysmorphia. I actually got to 17 and a half stone because of steroid misuse, because some of those performers, you know, they're in great shape, and you think, well, I need to look like that to be accepted within myself.
Right. And I think that's a pretty common experience we hear from men. Is that something that, as you've spoken with other men who have been through a pornography habit as well that you've had conversations with them about?
Yeah, it is. It is. Steroid misuse is another common trend that affects mental health, not limited to men, but mostly men's mental health. We're definitely seeing a shift whereby more men are being diagnosed with the eating disorders and body dysmorphia. 25% of those diagnosed with an eating disorder in the UK are men, and that's gone up year on year. And it's all down to do with that perception of self. I think unfairly and sadly, women were exposed to that earlier on, right? We had Vogue and Size Zero and all this ridiculous stuff that women should look like this or look like that. And now it's almost like caught up for men, where you've got reality TV shows and everyone's, you know, in great shape. Whereas maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, the male figure had no expectations.
And I, you know, that's something we're seeing from both men and women who consume pornography. But I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, some ways that pornography habits could kind of fly under the radar. What is it in all of the conversations you've had with individuals who've struggled with this, what you've seen in your own experience, what are some reasons that you think it's so easy for a pornography habit to fly under the radar in comparison to some other addictions?
Well, it's not illegal. Like, you know, if it's substances, drugs, there's that level of it's illegal. If it was alcohol, you know, I might be tired the next day and hungover. People might see signs of that. And with pornography, sadly, it's almost celebrated. It's normalized. It's, you know, it's just a bit of fun, right? It's just a bit of fun that everyone's involved in. So because it's almost celebrated and accepted and normalized, I think then people don't consider that it could be harmful for the consumer and for the people who are actually involved, the performers. And so I think that's why it kind of flies under the radar. And for me, like I said, it didn't get more extreme. It was almost like the same standard, watching the same videos even. Maybe if it had got more extreme, I'd have recognized it sooner. It wouldn't have flown under the radar. But there's so many different ways that I think people don't even consider that it could be an addiction. And when I talk and I teach and I say, look, there's a new addiction we need to be aware of. There's a new thing that's quite harmful. It's got these three A's. And people are almost like surprised, like, what? Like, I get them to guess and they often say smartphones or social media. And then we'll go that little bit deeper. And you can see that moment where they do, oh, wow, yeah, of course it would be. If that's what someone seeks out, that's how they get their dopamine, their excitement, and it's there and available all the time. They can see how harmful that would be.
And thank you for sharing that. I think that is something we hear commonly, and especially among men. I think culturally, it's normalized and celebrated, and increasingly for women as well, but especially among men, as it's almost like you're weird if you don't engage in pornography, or you're the odd one out if you're not interested in consuming this content. And so what was that like for you in pursuing recovery, if that's at all relatable culturally as a male with this normalized around you?
Yeah, it would have been hard to talk to certain friends about this. They wouldn't have understood. They'd have almost, you know, had a bit of a laugh and a joke with you. So I was kind of selective who I told initially, and who I told initially was through the app Relay, you know, like-minded people where I could be honest. But definitely there's still friends today who, when they listen to this podcast, they'll be quite surprised. So a group of friends who would kind of ridicule that. So I think being selective over who you tell, because there is that bravado. There is that you're what do you mean? You're strange. That's not an addiction. It's just a bit of fun. And it's like, well, not for me. It isn't. And when we will share videos on WhatsApps, because we've got the, you know, your groups, your social media groups, and some groups will share a video, and I'm like, whoa, I don't want to see that. Oh, let me take myself out of that group, because it's so normalized within that group. You're strange if you don't, with some people.
Right. As you've been in recovery and spoken with other individuals in recovery, have you seen that shifting at all, that as more people open up about this and share their experiences, that there is a shift in that culture? Or is it still feeling like it's the normalization is kind of overwhelmingly what most people are experiencing?
There is a definite shift, 100%. I think sadly, because more people are struggling with porn consumption, more people are seeking out recovery. and a relief to talk about it. See, 100%, we're seeing that shift, but things take time, sadly. You know, yeah. 10 years ago, there was a lot of stigma and judgment around mental health and mental illness, and yeah. we've seen that shift where celebrities come forward and they're openly talking about having a mental illness. So it is shifting. We will get there, down to the great work of your website and your podcast and your sharing information. I'll now share the link to your website when I teach, and we will see that shift. We are creating that community of people who are fighting for a better future without porn consumption. So keep going. We'll get there.
Thank you so much. And just for our listeners, we see that shift as well. You know, every time that someone opens up about this, is willing to share their story on a podcast or in a video or online in the comments of something, we are seeing more and more people, as you mentioned, unfortunately, because people are struggling, they are seeking out help. But we are seeing more and more people pursue recovery and choose a path where hopefully we can normalize not consuming pornography. We can normalize being fully educated about what it is. You know, if you consume other substances, smoke cigarettes, there's a warning label that says these are some potential, you know, harmful effects, and you can choose to consume this or not, but at least you have all the information. And that's just something that we haven't seen with pornography for so many generations, are that people are getting kind of sucked in and hooked when they're so young and they don't have all the information, and then the habit continues, right? And so for any of our listeners, just to know you are making a difference. Every time that you share an article or a video or a podcast episode or have a conversation about this in your personal life, it truly does help move that needle.
It does. It does. And that, we saw that shift with people talking about their mental health journey, and that needle's shifting dramatically. So, you know, keep sharing, keep talking. If you've got an issue with this, then it's okay to talk about, because that's how we make a change as a community, as a collective. Like you said about the warning label on cigarettes, things like that. Unless someone's got the awareness, the information, they're not making an informed choice. We can help support in them making an informed choice.
Right. You brought up mental health. How has your understanding of mental health and addiction changed over time?
It's changed in the view that there is no one way to recover. Typically in the realms of 12-step programs, in my experience, and like I said, they help loads of people, they are great, but it's almost like our way or no way. This one set process, you've got to work through the steps, and that isn't the case. We are individuals. My journey of recovery may well look different to anyone else's, and that's okay. So it's person-centered rather than this or that. It's a whole host of things. It's about shaping what that looks like for you so you can live your life. It doesn't have to be a miserable life living in recovery or sober or avoiding that thing that's drawn you in. It can be a great life. It can be a freeing life. It can be peaceful and calm, but there's no one way. It's not a linear journey.
And a reminder to any of our listeners who may be struggling with the pornography habit and feel like, you know, I tried this and it didn't work, or I tried that and it didn't work. Just know there are so many different resources available to you that can help you overcome this. And as you mentioned, you know, no one resource is exactly right for everyone. So just because something didn't work doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you or that you are broken or that recovery is not possible for you. Recovery is possible. We've seen so many different people achieve recovery through so many different methods and platforms. So we would just encourage you to keep going and try another avenue. Ryan, is there anything we haven't talked about yet today that you were hoping to share on our podcast?
There's not, to be fair. You put together some great questions. I think we've covered some great topics. I really appreciate you having me on, because I've been a follower of yours for a while now. You probably see that I share your posts. So, you know, I'm just really grateful to you for the support you've given me through your sharing of information and, you know, talking about this. It was a relief to see your site and your socials to know this is a thing. It's got a community and a load of followers. So thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan. We appreciate your support. This can be difficult work, as you know, to be in this space. And it's always so encouraging to know that our resources are accomplishing what we set out to have them accomplish, and that this work and this movement is making the difference that we believe it can. The beautiful thing about a grassroots movement is It takes everyone and every person who is participating in this movement to any degree is truly helping to build this momentum to move this forward. So whether that's donating to our nonprofit or reading or sharing an article or having a conversation with your sibling or your coworker or your partner or your parent about this topic, every single one of those efforts helps to move this movement forward and change the conversation about pornography from what we're really talking about, to change this from something that's culturally normalized to something that everyone knows all of the potential harmful effects on individuals' relationships and the effects on society. And so we're so grateful for your work in this space and your willingness to share your story so vulnerably on our podcast today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Consider Before Consuming. Consider Before Consuming is brought to you by Fight the New Drug. Fight the New Drug is a non-religious and a non-legislative organization that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on its harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. Check out the episode notes for resources mentioned in this episode. If you find this podcast helpful, consider subscribing and leaving a review. Thanks again for listening. We invite you to increase your self-awareness, look both ways, check your blind spots, and consider before consuming.
We've heard from so many people who say they've tried everything to quit porn. Filters, blockers, restricting access to apps, even flip phones, only to fall back into the same cycle. Because the real battle isn't with your browser. It's with what you're feeling. That's the problem Relay is designed to solve. Relay helps you spot the triggers behind your urges and connects you to a community that actually understands what you're going through. Instead of fighting this alone, you get accountability, tools, and real-time support when you need it most. And that's not about shame. It's about building a life where you don't need porn anymore. And right now is the best time for you to try it. For our No Porn November campaign, Relay is offering a free 30-day trial to our listeners. Imagine going a whole month without porn. It's possible with real accountability and support backing you up. Head to joinrelay.app/consider and start your 30 days free today.